Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 6th, 1999. In the fireside room this evening are Mary Ildisacker Nelson and Roy Nelson. Today's session number is 99-9 and it's titled The Enneagram in Parenting. What's with my kid? Let's listen to it.
Let me just remind you one more time of Enneagram books that are available. Most of these are available in the library, the reference section on the right-hand side. By Helen Palmer, The Enneagram in Love and Work. I want to take down names and buy them some other, you know, when you get back home. Three by Brené Baron and Elizabeth Waggeley, Are You My Type, Am I Yours? The Enneagram of Parenting, and Mary may have some references from that.
The Enneagram Made Easy, does somebody have
and
that?
And the Enneagram Made Easy.
Borrowed it?
Okay,
you
she borrowed it.
Last
okay,
time.
Very
the
good.
The Enneagram Made Easy,
okay. Very good. And you're going to. And then this book, which is relatively new, it's only been out for about 3 or 4 months, The Wisdom of the Enneagram by Don Riso and Russ Hudson, which really is a very, very helpful book.
I didn't have much time.
They don't have that one yet.
If you were going to purchase one of the books, that's...
This would be it, yeah. This would be it.
I've been just, I didn't have time to really explore it much before we left because I've been teaching all summer, and the, so
I've
while
read,
I'm here, I've been
yeah,
reading it.
I've read quite a bit of it, and it's much better than their first major book, which was kind of the definitive work in Enneagram, and this is really very helpful. And then the Stanford Enneagram, are there some of you who are handing them in tonight?
I think we have almost everything.
Think it, and you've got one too.
I did already.
Oh, you got it here. Okay, do you cross out your name so that we find? Okay, you got it all. Okay. Were there any others who wanted one? Okay, you'd like. The next class is tomorrow at 9 o'clock, and we're on the bus at 10:45. So that gives you that. You know, it's either this or ice cream tonight.
We don't want to have to carry a lot of stuff, we're going to pack all this tonight.
Yeah.
If you don't think you're going to read it.
Yeah.
Okay, how many new people here tonight?
Do you have anybody? My goodness. Yeah. Okay. What I'm
going to
do in terms of a review, especially for the new people, is on this. Has everybody got this piece?
Back here.
Why don't you turn to the first page, look at the first page of this, the Enneagram, and then look here at the Enneagram symbol, which I put on the board. Ennea is the Greek word for nine. Basically, in this system, we're talking about nine basic personality types, okay? And that each of us has is weighted in our life toward one of these types. Because we are weighted towards a type does not mean that we're locked into that type. It does mean that that's where we can be pretty confident that a good share of what goes on with us is because we are in one of these areas. So as we look at them, 2, 3, and 4 are the heart fire. These are people who deal with feelings. Lots of feeling stuff here. And their basic anxiety is the anxiety about how they appear to others. They're always wondering if they are making the impression, the right impression on the people out there. Okay? So that's the 2s, 3s, and 4s. The 5, 6, and 7 are in the head triad. These are thinking people. These folks that sometimes are so much in their heads, it's like they don't own a body. Like all they are is this from here on up. Because so much of their life is just, they're processing always up here, okay? Those folks' basic issue is fear, okay? That's their basic issue, okay?
Not that a lot of them would ever admit it.
No, we don't admit it at all. But I'm a six. I'm not afraid of anything. Of course. Yeah. So when we look at fear and we look at anxiety about image and
oh, should have the anger.
Yeah, anger. Or paralysis. Sorry, thank you for the corrective. And for this triad, anger is the negative, or the shadow part of us, okay? Each of us has a gift. And for those of you who have been here for, let me finish this. The third triad is people who experience things right here, in the gut, you know? And there's enough evidence already that the things are going on here almost like they are in the brain, you know, in terms of communicating. And this is about relating. These people are this whole tribe is about relating, and anger is the really the shadow piece. Let's just quickly talk about the gifts. Do you remember what the gift of the two is?
Caregiver.
He's the caregiver. This is the helper, okay? The three?
Workers.
Achiever.
This is the achiever, this is the builder, this is the person. I can get that done for you. Absolutely. The four?
Romantic artist. Workers.
This is the artist, this is the unique person. I am, you know, I am special. Yeah.
Are you peeking at your sheets?
Yeah. Okay, that's all right. I asked them to turn to the first page, so I mean there's no cheaters here at all. And a five, what's the gift?
Knowing.
Knowledge, that's right. That's the gift. Number six, the gift is?
Observing, questioning.
Faithfulness is loyalty is a big issue here. Number seven, the gift is?
Joy.
Okay. Joy. Okay. Number eight, the gift is
power.
Nine, the gift is
harmony,
peace, those kind of things. And the gift of one,
perfection.
Oh, and the real gift is concern for justice, completeness, wholeness, all of those. So all these people have gifts. We all have gifts, and we all have we all abuse those gifts. Use the gifts in ways that are not healthy for us. And the underside of it all for this triad is anxiety about image. This triad is fear, and this triad is anger. That's a quick review, okay? Then we have, if you are, I'm a six, for instance. Every number has two wings. The wings are the numbers either on both sides of this number. So I happen to be a six with a five wing. So I end up oftentimes being very concerned with knowledge, with learning, with growing, with all that kind of stuff. And these folks sometimes isolate themselves. And Mary will tell you that I'm always hiding. I'm always trying to get away by myself. So I'm a six with a five. So any number here, you look to the number going clockwise, is how you relate to the world.
Usually this is the number that pulls you into the world, and this is the number that pulls you into yourself somehow.
Yeah. So if I'm relating to the world, I think my congregation thinks that I'm a pretty joyful guy at times. You know, but then they could be mistaken. You know, and then so as I project myself into the world, I often have this as I'm turning in, looking at myself, it's mostly this. Okay, those are wings. The arrows are, where do I go? What characteristics does each of these pick up when they are secure? Notice the arrows that go from six. This arrow comes in to six. That means I pick up the good qualities, the peacefulness, the harmoniousness of the nine. This is my gift is peace or harmony. The arrow that goes away from your number is the arrow you go to in stress. And three is the person is the builder, the doer, the get things done. And sometimes I go in there in negative stress, and the things I get done don't make any difference. I told the class before, you know, I can get obsessive about cleaning my office, you know, And my secretary will come in and see me doing that, and she'll look around and, well, nice job, you know, and then she'll leave.
What's bothering you? Yeah.
Yeah, what's bothering me? She knows that something, I'm not feeling very secure, you know. And I also get very competitive. Trees are very competitive when they're not in particularly good health. And so that's the negative for me, and here is the positive. So as you look at the arrows coming toward your number are coming from the place of security that you're deeming the qualities of that type, and the arrow that goes from you to another number is where you go in stress. Okay, you have some questions about that?
Quick look. What about five? Where does five go in stress?
Five goes in stress to seven.
Oh, to seven. Okay.
You become a monkey mind.
That's right. Instead of being focused like where five usually is, mm-hmm. you know, just all over the place.
Now, would five have a wing of a four?
You have a wing of a four.
Yes.
Five can have a wing of a four.
Okay.
And then you see, those people who are here have a greater appreciation for the next triad. Uh-huh. Whereas those of us in the middle, threes, sixes, and nines, you know, we don't quite mm-hmm. get the rest of this.
People, fours with a five wing and fives with a four wing tend to be the most complicated people. And, you know, they kind of talk about crossing this abyss.
Yeah.
I think, whatever that means.
Okay. Yesterday we talked about the workplace. Here's a couple of them. Sometimes when my colleague complains about something not getting done right, something that anybody would do, I respond by taking time to do it and do it right. Because I get sick of hearing the complaining. Now I talked to the person who wrote this and since he thinks he's a six, this also fits my personality type. So one of the things, you see something that isn't being done, and you will do it. A six often will do it, because you want everything to look good in this institution or corporation for which you're working. However, be careful on this kind of thing, because you might be dealing with the kind of person that always gets other people to do your work. Their work. There are some people, in fact, we had a pastor here who had to leave this morning, and that was one of the issues in her congregation. One of the staff members always seemed to have other people, get other people to do her work. So she could say at the end, well, you know, this is all done. But she's really kind of lazy. I don't know if that's the problem with that situation, but that is a possibility. But sixes often will pick up
that kind of thing.
They're so loyal. Oh yeah, are we loyal? Are we loyal? Absolutely, are we loyal?
Oh, yes,
are we faithful? Okay, sometimes when my colleagues at the university ask me to do something, namely take on some meaningful service or task, I respond by wanting to do it, and 8 times out of 10 taking on the responsibility, often overextending myself. I want to help out, make a contribution, and be involved. The key maybe here is often overextending myself. Why do you need to do that?
Two need to be needed.
Well, this guy isn't a two. A two certainly would want to do that. This fellow is a six. This fellow is a six.
Commitment to the institution.
Yeah, you got a commitment, you know, loyalty to the department, loyalty to the chair of the department, loyal to yourself. You're going to look, this will also help you, you know, you do those things. And sometimes, even though, you know, I want to do it, I want to help out and make a contribution, because I am that loyal person. Question is, if you're overextending yourself and maybe wearing yourself out with this stuff, what kind of negative impact is that going to finally turn on? And then another one. When my senior colleague jokes about my impending replacement, I respond by playing along with the joke and jab back, quote, jokingly, unquote, as well. because I don't want to submit to his assault, and I don't want to appear susceptible to his power, or his display of power. Well, this, if the individual is indeed a six, security is very important to a six. I fear, I'm a six, I have a lot of fear around the issues of security. And when this guy keeps throwing out this idea of replacement, that makes me nervous. I start thinking of all kinds of things. So how do I respond to him? I respond to him, if I'm a phobic six, probably not by not challenging him at all. But sixes have two. They're phobic sixes and counterphobic. And counterphobic sixes will jab back. That's what this jabbing back is, you know. And they will try to get the guy, you know. We have our own way of dealing with these people, you know, who are trying to make us feel insecure. So those are quick responses to some job situations. I appreciate your gentlemen. Hope that might be helpful. Mary is now going to lead the session.
For the tape people, if you thought that you should have turned it on before, you're wrong. now is the time. Roll the tape. Roy and Mary Nelson on the Enneagram Tool for Interpersonal Understanding, Session 4 on Parenting. I'd like to begin with a Bible verse and then talk a little bit about it, and a prayer, and then talk a little bit about the verse and go on from there. And finally, we'll start getting into some of the nitty-gritty stuff about kiddos. The verse is from Proverbs. And I would be very surprised if a lot of you have not heard this verse. Train up a child in the way he should go, or train up children in the way they should go, and when they're old, they will not depart from it. Shall we pray? Oh God, we pray for your grace in this very difficult task of parent and child relationships. We pray for joy, we pray for letting go. We pray for a return in full measure of the love that we give to all these little ones that we put out into the world. And we ask that you would guard us and keep us and guide us in all the decisions we make around our children. In your name we pray. Amen. This verse is interesting and it's a little bit problematic. Because the assumption, it reminds me of John Bradshaw. Do you know his work, parody work? Yeah. And the assumption of a lot of his books is that if you do it right, they'll turn out right. If you parent right, the kids will turn out right. And there seems to be that assumption built into this verse also. If you do it right, the kid is going to come out right. What people don't always notice in this verse is the line, when they're old. When they're old, you know. And a lot of times we parents never live long enough to see the fruits of our labors. And sometimes our kids never live long enough to get old. And that happens. We've seen, all of us probably know of kids that through overdosing or car accidents or whatever all in their rebellious phases, they just didn't get old. So they didn't have a chance to show that they had not departed from the way that they were trained. So you've got to think about what that verse is doing to you. When you think about it. But more importantly, what I want to take from this verse and kind of sail with is the first two words, train up. Train up. We all come at our parenting standing on a metaphor. And often that metaphor is hidden. It's a hidden metaphor. We don't ever am life, what it is that we're thinking that parenting is all about. And training up is a metaphor. What is it a metaphor of?
A vine going around a trellis, perhaps?
Well, it could be that, yeah. Or you train a puppy. What were you going to say, Bob?
An animal.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of a Pavlovian thing, you know. You train them. You make them run through their hoops. Training is a metaphor. And you can use that as a metaphor for children if you want to. But you have to realize it's a metaphor. That's all it is. The concept of training up is a metaphor for thinking about children. What are some other metaphors that people have for raising children? Have you ever thought about this? Sometimes, I should wait a little longer. What?
Gardening.
Could be gardening, and I want to get to that one. What are some other ones?
Bird nest.
Yes, protecting the child, and then
push them out.
Push them out. Right. Mm-hmm. That would be a metaphor. Yep. Some people think of the potter and the clay, that you get this shapeless mass, and it's our job as a parent to mold, to shape, to, right? The blank slate is another one. Mm-hmm. That this child comes to you as a blank slate and you write upon it. And what that child gets is what you write.
An empty vessel
you pour into it, right? And so you carefully pour in, and what they have is what you have put in. That's another metaphor.
And a ship getting ready to launch?
Yes. Like outfitting a ship. Yeah. To get them ready to launch, making it shipworthy. Seaworthy, is that the word, isn't it? Shipworthy. Do you see all the different metaphors that we have? And each metaphor will produce a whole different set of behaviors in parenting. And I haven't thought this through totally, but I'm thinking that the metaphor we choose, the metaphor that just comes naturally to us, probably has something to do with our type. But I want to present a metaphor that I think fits this whole idea of type pretty well, and that is that parents are gardeners who plant seeds from unmarked packages. Unmarked packages. And you don't know what it is that is going to come up. And I want you to turn to the back side of this. If we ascribe to this theory, and it is just that, it's theory. It's some way to think and to process the world. It's theory. If we ascribe to that theory, we can assume that the seed we plant will contain one of the God gifts. The part of the seed will be a piece of God, will be a genetic component of God, the God of joy, the God of love, the God of justice, the God of caring, and so on. And that part of that seed is also this curse. So that the nine, this wonderful person who's a harmonizer, has the curse of sloth. The one, the curse of resentment or anger. Two, pride. Three, deceit. Right. Even if they haven't been successful, they will lie to themselves and to everybody else to let you know how successful they've been. Four, envy. Five, avarice. Six, fear or courage or doubt. Seven, gluttony. That really makes me feel good. I have a seven. And eight, lust. So that this seed that is planted and that comes into the world contains a God component and it contains some kind of a curse. And that's what the theory would tell you. So what do we do as parent gardeners? When we have this thing that starts to grow, And we don't know if it's like a cactus that doesn't need much water, or if it's like an aloe vera plant that needs some water but not a lot, or if it's like a hibiscus that you have to drench every day. You know, we don't know, do we? See, you know, you just gotta do your best. But the fact is, it's all kind of trial and error, and we need to be really gracious with ourselves for the trial and error. Our parents did trial and error on us, we do trial and error on our kids, they will do trial and error on their kids, and that's the best we can hope for in this world, because you don't know. It's an unmarked package. Anybody that's had, how many of you have children at home right now, like under 18? Yeah, sorry. Yeah. How many have more than one child? Okay. How many of you with more than one child felt the difference between the children, even in your utero, or certainly within the first year? You didn't feel a utero? Oh. You failed.
First day.
Be gentle with yourself.
Yeah. Kids come different. I mean, they literally come different. I was talking just out in the hallway about our oldest son, who slept like 15 minutes around the clock at a time for the first year of his life. Never more than 15 or 20 minutes. Just ding, you know, just hyper, wild, crazy kid. And another child we had that was just gentle and huggy and calm and, you know, just, I don't think I did it to them after they were born. I don't think they came as a blank slate. But that's what I was taught in college. That was the behaviorist psychological model of the time. The kids come in as blank slates. We know a lot now about genetics and the kids that people are just different. So, when you're talking about your children, or when you're thinking about your children, and you're trying to use this particular model of thinking, Enneagram, to think about parenting and to think about your children, the first thing to figure out is who you are, and what your strengths are, and what your weaknesses are. And if you are as healthy a self as you can be, you're not going to make really bad blunders. I mean, your kids might be really difficult, but you know, it's that the stress of parenting often puts us into a very stressed, average health self. And you know, we all just kind of muddle through together in all kinds of weird ways. One of the problems with typing children, and this is the first caution, I'm going to just caution you about some things, and I hope you'll write this down and remember it. Don't be really certain your kid is something. Be really cautious about typing your kid. Because for one thing, would you want someone to type you? No, of course you wouldn't. For another thing, if you were a kid, would you want your parents coming home and saying, I know what you are? No, of course you wouldn't. And finally, you don't know. You don't know. But what's important is to know that there are differences, and to know that your child may in fact be a very different basic personality type from the type you are. Interestingly enough, in our family, I had the most trouble with the kid that was the most like me. One of our children is a 7. And insofar as I liked myself, I liked her. And insofar as I didn't like myself, I didn't like her at all. I mean, she just brought out the worst in me, the best and the worst. And got really my worst parenting because she was the most like me. And with my other children, I saw differences that I found, you know, sort of interesting. But one of the reasons why you can't know for sure is that the process of growing up is stressful, period. Some homes for no particular fault of the parents, or maybe because of the problems of the parents, some homes are much more stressful than others. Sometimes situations happen that are stressful. You move, people die, people get divorced, all kinds of things happen that produce stress in a home. So that your kid may well be living in their stress point most of their childhood. They could well be living in their stress point. I don't think anybody, wait a minute, Bob, you knew me when I was little. Did I look like a seven?
I wouldn't have. Yes, but
no. No. And our daughter Linnea lived her whole childhood as a one. Now the ones are the perfectionists. And we had this wild and crazy eight power guy oldest son that never slept and that was mean and beat up on people all the time. And then we had a nine second son. And then this seven daughter. And she took it upon herself to redeem the family name from the trouble that these boys caused. And she became an obsessively perfect child. And I loved it in some ways, but I knew it wasn't healthy, you know. So I would not have guessed her a seven growing up. This child, the nine, the brother, younger brother, lived in stress his whole childhood because of, maybe because we were crummy parents too, but I like to think it was because of this older brother. So he lived in his stress point, which is six, most of his life. Now, interestingly enough, for both of them as adults, I think that was a good thing. Because nines tend to be very just float. A pure nine floats. Our youngest daughter, who lived in a much less stressful house, is a pure nine, and she still is very nine-ish, and she just kind of is, oh yeah, she just kind of floats, and she diddles, and she's nice, and she, you know, it's just kind of one of these free spirits. You know her.
Yes.
Is that fair?
She was a good student.
But she did float a little, didn't she?
I don't think it would be professional for me to comment.
any kid who goes to St. Ola for 4 years spends $20,000 a year, and we come to the graduation, and she has her graduation project, and it is a quilt this size. Has been floating. Absolutely.
That's one of the reasons I think they banged the Pierre College in St. Olaf. But for her,
yeah, a great time. Work? What do you mean?
The son that lived in sixth space under stress, sixes are responsible, they're mature, they're dependable, they get things done. And he now brings all of that training in getting things done into his nineness as an adult. And so he's very productive and dependable and, you know, gets things done because he's picked up this energy. And the seven is extremely, does really precise and careful work because she's learned all this one energy. And she gets things done also. Sevens have a hard time getting things done. But all of this is meant to say, you don't know. It's also meant to say, it might not necessarily be a bad thing that your kid grows up in their stress point. You see, it might not be a bad thing that your kid grows up in their stress point. Because they pick up well another energy source that they can then bring all of the attributes up into their own.
And even if the stress point is negative, they can pick up the positive side of the stress point, too.
Also, yeah. The only two people in our family, kids that grew up not in their stress point, were the eight, the oldest one, who just was a power guy right from the start, and the youngest one, nine, yeah. Solely for other reasons, she's a one, and she spent a lot of time in four space growing up. So, anyway, does that give you some idea of the complexities of really knowing what your kids are? The second thing that happens is there's this process called parental interjection. And parents try to shape their children according to their own image. And their image is determined by who they are. So parents who are one want their children to be, to do the right thing, right?
Right.
was that
the right answer?
That was the right answer. Okay. Parents who are twos want their children to grow up helpful and kind and loving. That would be their highest value. Parents who are three want their kids to be successful. That would be their highest value. Parents who are four want their kids to be unique and creative. That would be their highest value. I have a friend whose kid is who's a four, and her kid was just this weird nerd. I mean, that any other parent would have been just like, whoa, you know. And she just thought he was incredible. And she was so proud of this weird, nerdy kid because that was her value. Her value was weirdness.
Careful.
John.
Look out for be careful for terminology.
Yeah. Would you say your value is weirdness?
No, creativity.
Creativity. Oh, I'm sorry. Wrong language.
That doesn't say the giftedness is weirdness.
No. Five parents. The prime attribute or value is knowledge. That their kids be bright and that they do well in school. For sixes, the prime value is that the kids be responsible and dependable and faithful, that they go to the right places, they do the right things, they don't betray people, they don't, you know what I'm saying. Yeah. For sevens, the prime attribute is that your kids have fun and that home be fun and that the place, that things be joyful, that spirits be light. For the eight, I think that the prime attribute would be that the kids be strong, and yet there's a real tension there because as soon as the kids are strong, they're going to butt up against the eight parent. Are you finding that with your daughter, who you think is eight?
That we butt up against?
No, that her kiddos butt up against her.
Her children are very passive.
Oh, they're passive.
I don't know why God did that. Why God didn't give them
give her what she did, what she was.
I prayed for that.
Yes.
And what did she give?
There's no justice in this.
She got the children. Yes. They're obedient. They're compliant. It's just not fair.
No, it's just because she was a better mom.
Maybe.
Yeah. And nine parents just want peace in the house. They want kids to be nice, to just be peaceful, to not fight, just have a nice house. Did I say ones? No. Ones want their kids to do the right thing, to just know the right thing and to do it. So you can see that the parents bring up, and then of course often there's two parents and they're usually not the same type. So often there will be a double interjection depending on which parent has the most influence on the kid. And so kids, depending on their type again, may try to be compliant. Two children will want to be liked, and if their parents are fives, they will study their tails off to try to do well because they want to be liked, you know. And so this whole business of parental interjection of type, they say that the people have to be in their 20s and away from home and kind of on their own and able to financially make decisions that are choices rather than sort of forced upon them by economics or whatever, before they can really sort of float into who they really are.
Marie, does it cause confusion very often getting
two different messages from parents, or how do children typically work with that? Because here's two parents I'm crazy about both of them, and this one's this one. Mm-hmm. Does that often get confusing, or is that just, how does that work?
I think finally it makes them more mature. Of course it's confusing, but you know, once they get out in the world, they're going to be getting a million messages. So they might as well learn how to go back and forth. I hear this, I hear this. What is my choice going to be? I mean, that's finally the decision the kids have to make.
Does it help them develop other traits, like wings or
yes.
traits?
Yeah. So they and of course you want to be as whole a person as you can be. And so these parental interjections, if you're a, for instance. I'm a 7. My guess is that my mother was a 6. My guess is that my father was a 1. I had an older sister who was a 5. And so all of those sibling things, by the way, are powerful.
Yes.
I mean, they're finding out more and more how really powerful the interjection of the sibling trait is into kids. So all of those things were interjected into me, and I picked up pieces of all of them. You know, and that's good. That's good.
That's what's really helpful, I think, for parents to know their own type and to talk with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really one of the great benefits of this piece. And when parents will sit down and talk this through, so they have an understanding of who they are. It's one of the greatest helps to the kids.
So you can give an I wish message from who you really are.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what I wish for you. Here's what your dad
wishes for you.
For you.
But here are other options.
Right.
Here are
That's
other
right.
choices.
Yeah.
You know, and they're not bad.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, show them the graph. You know, you could be any one of these things, and every one of them is wonderful.
Yeah.
And we may be able to understand one type better than another. You know. I think three parents, success-driven parents, tend to they just don't really understand these 9 kind of floating kids, you know? They just don't get it. They don't get why they're not just out there. Just, I mean, they're bright and they're just not out there. They're not getting them. 8 parents have an interesting time with 4 children, you know? So, who are the most emotional, the most heart people, weeping and caring on and sobbing. So, and then an 8 parent would just say, well, get over it. What is wrong with you? Forget it. Get over it. Move on. You know? Oh, but I'm
Sarah, 7 parents do that, 2 to 4s.
7 parents do that to 4s.
Oh, yeah.
Tell them to get on. Yeah, get over it. Yeah.
Jane has a question.
Yes.
I was wondering, in just in terms of a child's development, and the fact that some of this, is there a way in which what you might have to watch is that at a certain stage they're this, but it's that they kind of move through, I mean, the whole range of them to some extent? I mean, you know that funny thing that they'll tell you after a certain amount of time, suddenly you can one day feel like you really have a quite different child from what you had, say, a year ago,
mm-hmm.
or whatever, so that I'm not saying you might be able to identify where they are at a given time, but you just have to keep it open that they may be somewhere else.
Yeah.
They may be
don't
several different
in.
Places before.
Sure.
Yeah, don't lock it in.
Lock
That's
it
right.
in, yeah.
Don't
yeah.
lock it in.
Yeah. And, you know, when you go on vacation and everybody's having a good time, your kid may well be in their security point. And when you get home, they may pass right through their own point and into their stress without a stop. Don't, you know, do not pass go. Do not collect 100. They're right there because as soon as they get back and they're in the neighborhood or they're in school or whatever, a little bit of distress. That's
or
what
the irony is, it could be the other way around.
It could be the other way around. The parents go into stress when they're on vacation.
Yeah, well, you think the kids are going to have a wonderful time,
yeah.
and everything they're used to is
gone.
And
yeah.
they.
Well, our kids were, I think, more peaceful at home, and we'd go on vacation, and I would drive 12 hours a day with 5 kids in the car, you know, and by the time we got there, you know, and there were times when they were so stressed out, you know, just because of, I had to get there, you see, and they they were in the car and they didn't make any choices.
Okay, so never, rule number one, never assume you know. Rule number two, what's right for one child could well be wrong for another. And I cannot tell you how many child-rearing books gave me advice that was not helpful with my 8 sons. And particularly books that said, that would say things like, families set up rules and they set up regulations and they set up orders and the child is expected to do it. Or people at the church. I mean, my husband's a pastor and we had a child who hated church. He's also a pastor now, which is
God got him.
He's been paying the price ever since. But I can't tell you the number of people who said to me, of course you make your children go to church. It's just what you do. Children go to church. It was just a given in our home. There was no question about it. You just go to church. And I think we would have been in so much trouble with that kid if we had made him go to church, because he would have hated church. And it was a vindicating thing for me when he ended up in treatment. And when we went down for the family treatment program, and what they told us was that they were extraordinarily surprised at how quickly he was able to accept the notion of a higher power and move into the spiritual dimensions of the program. And that most preachers' kids that they get, they can never do it because they have had so much guilt laid on them and so much God stuff, and religion is used for behavior modification and manipulation all the time. And I guess because I grew up as a preacher's kid, and that's what was done to me, I didn't do it to them. And I somehow knew that. But all the advice was, he's a preacher's kid, you go. And
our kids would call up, I'd be in the church office getting ready for service, and one of the kids would call and they'd say, because we always had lots of pets at our house, you know, and we had a cat named Cruella DeVille. And I can still hear the phone call, you know, Daddy, do we have to go to church today? Cruella's having her babies.
Yeah.
And I'd say, no, what's got at work at home?
Yeah.
We never pushed to that. Even though there was the pressure in the congregation to push that.
You know, how could we expect our children to go to church if you don't expect your children to go to church? Well, you know, that's true, and I'm sorry that we made problems for you, but...
that's why I didn't last in Paris, as you see. Are you moving on yet?
Rule number three. Oh, another little example of what's wrong for one child is right for another. With our 8 kid, or with our one child, we would never ever need to and never should say, you've got to think about being successful. You need to try, you've got to go for it, you've got to try to win, you've got to be the best. To say that adds a thousand times the pressure that they already feel to do that, because that's who they are. But 9 kids need that kind of push. Hey, you're so gifted. You know, you could be so successful. Just go for it. Go for it. You've got to encourage them to come down to this free place of achievement. And so it kind of went against my grain to do that, but then I finally realized that's what certain kids need. Rule number three. Well, this is a typical interesting 7 thing. I've got rule number 1, rule number 2, rule number 3, rule number 3. This is the first 3. If a child is quite different from you, you didn't do it to them. You know, you didn't do it to them. The they come in with a certain gift. They're born with the God seed and the curse. They're born with that. And then there's you. If we're going to go back to our garden metaphor, you can water and you can prune and you can carry out all you want, but there's still the sun you can't control. There's the vermin you can't control, like the kids in the neighborhood, you know. There's all kinds of people. And then at some point, sometimes when they're one and sometimes when they're three and sometimes when they're five and certainly by the time they're six, they are in fact transplanted. And most of their time is spent in somebody else's garden. And then you can't control that at all. What happens to them in school? So parents have to just really relax a little bit and, you know, recognize the limits of their power and the limits of their authority.
The Serenity Prayer is very good for parents.
Yes, very good. I hope you all know that. You can't make one kind of child into another, even as you can't make an oak tree into a weeping willow or a flowering almond. You know, we could not have made our eight son into a five, a scholar. We could not have made our one child into a two or a three or a four. I mean, you can't do it. You can't do it any more than you can make a plant from one thing into another. You can try to graft stuff in, I suppose, and sometimes the grafts take, but basically, people are who they are, you know. So what I thought I would spend the rest of the time doing, which is sort of an interesting thing, is thinking about each of these types of children. And if you are in, say, an academic town, like the town our kids grew up in, is Iowa City, where grades were a value, right? Intelligence was a value, university-dominated town. And your kid has an IQ of, say, 135, if you recognize the IQ system, which I don't necessarily, but anyway, it does test how well you do in school. It tests that. So that kind of an IQ would be smart enough to do well if you tried, and not so smart to get you in trouble, right? Okay. Let's just go around the circle, and how would each of these types, do you think, fare academically in a high school where academics was something of a value? Okay? How do you think that one would do?
Excellent.
Hmm?
Excellent.
Yeah. What kind of, what would be going on inside the one most of the time?
Tight,
stress. Pressure, want to be valedictorian, panic at every end of every semester. Will they keep their straight A's? You know, how will they do on the SATs? Yeah, tons of internal pressure, but will probably be a valedictorian, right? I mean, because that's what ones do, they get it all right. I mean, they pay a big price for it inside, but they do it right. Were you valedictorian? No. two. What would a two? How would a two fare?
Pretty well. Make the teacher happy.
Okay, do you think that high school kids care about making teachers happy?
Maybe tutoring kids. Parents happy. Try to make the parents try to do well.
They're going to try to make the other kids happy who are all stressed out, and then they're going to have problems probably.
Yeah, it could go in a bunch of different directions, but most likely high school age twos are totally wrapped up in their peer group. You know, they might be the cheerleaders, they might be the in their clubs, they might be the doers, they might be, you know, they're really out there doing all kinds of stuff. And probably wouldn't feel the internal pressure to push it through. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The problems they're going to have in school, are it's not going to be that kind of tension. It's going to be more somebody doesn't like me, these girl fights the kids get into, and they get rejected and outcast, and, you know, you're nodding if you know about that. So that would be the kinds of problems that a two would more likely have. And unless they really, really, really love their teachers, and they would have to love them all, they're going to mess up somewhere along the line. You know, maybe Phi Ed, they're going to get a C, and maybe, and whatever. Threes, how are they going to do?
Very well.
Extra credit.
Join everything. Probably, yeah. They may or may not make it to a straight A, depending on whether they're captain of the football team and first chair trumpet and, you know, what exactly their parental value system is and what value system they pick up. They're going to be best at what they do, but it may or may not be academics, but they'll do well. The fours. They're not going to do very well?
Yes, they will.
They're too creative.
Because in leisure, you go to one, and that can mean you're going to do well.
When has high school ever been leisure?
Well, if your parents are pushing you and your brother was a one.
Are we speaking autobiographically here? So, were you a valedictorian?
I tried. No. 12.
It depends on whether your teachers recognize your creative answers as being the great answer.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. It depends upon whether teacher and whether a four could get through 4 years of high school with every quarter having every teacher recognizing the glory of creativity and the wonder of originality. Not our high school.
Most teachers do not recognize that. Most teachers are the Myers-Briggs SJs.
Yeah.
My guess would be it would go either really well or really poorly, but the idea being a C average person would be the problem.
But they'd be very dramatic about it.
Right. Yeah. I have a niece who's a four, and very bright four, and she either got A pluses in things or Fs. And she got the Fs when she just would get into huge feuds with the teacher, because the teacher just was absolutely ridiculous and, you know, was not worthy of their salt or blah, 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 you know. So so fours could go either way, but usually the dramas that they're going through keep them from that kind of stalwart, steady, just do it kind of life. They don't just do it. They weep and they
gnash their teeth.
Five. Are they going to be valedictorian? No?
Yeah. If they're interested in the subjects.
Yeah.
That's a problem with fives. Yeah. They usually the fives don't make it to valedictorian because they flunked home ec or gotten a C. They've gotten a C in Phi Ed.
Maybe C and PE.
C, yeah.
PE.
PE. If I had what? Yeah. PE. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe they're total math geeks, but they hate English. You know, so they do A plus in math and trigonometry and advanced physics and, you know, I mean, they're doing like graduate level college work by the time they're seniors, but they're getting C's in average lit classes. You know, that would be more the, well, Bill Gates, didn't he flunk out of college or something? Or he quit? Yeah.
He dropped out.
Yeah.
He did okay, but he was really not eligible.
No.
Because he was always at the computer.
Right, yeah. It's a very focused intelligence. Sixes, how are they going to do?
President of the choir.
President of the choir. Are we speaking autobiographically here?
So.
Yes. So was he.
Were you president of the choir?
No.
Well, super manager.
I was the manager of the choir.
Yeah.
College choirs need managing because they go on tours in Europe and all over the place.
What do you think, sixes?
institution built too. Yeah,
they do pretty well. They do pretty well.
Follow the rules.
Yeah. If they're a phobic, I don't know if you've caught on that language, phobic means fear. So if they're a fearful six, if they understand their fears, the fears will motivate them to do well. If they're a counterphobic six, like somebody whose name I won't mention, then the teacher has to prove themselves. And
so challenging the authority.
You challenge the authority, and if a teacher isn't worthy, then the student vanishes. So I used to meet him at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and he'd be just getting out of bed at college, you know, because the teachers weren't worthy, you see. And sixes could get into some of that kind of stuff. Sevens, how are they going to do?
Have fun.
Easy class.
What?
We're going to take easier classes and do well on
them. Yeah. Yeah, that could be.
And fool the teacher.
What?
And fool the teacher.
And fool the teacher. Really good at fooling the teacher. I'm a terrible speller, but nobody ever caught on because I was bright, and so people, you know, teachers give a lot of slack to people they think are bright. I mean, they assume the right. And I got really good at making A's that looked sort of like E's. They were sort of these funny little, so it could be either an A or an E.
She flunked penmanship.
Interestingly, though, when sevens get under stress, they go here. So our seven daughter, except for one B plus in high school, and college was almost straight A's. Graduate school, she was the top student because she spent most of that time at one, and she was just obsessive, just absolutely obsessive about doing well. And sevens can really get into that space of just obsession about doing well. What about eights? How are they going to do?
They're practicing football.
They're practicing football, yeah.
They might get kicked out of school.
They might get kicked out of school. School is not a good place for eights. Would that be a fair thing to say? Tom and Billy have a girl eight and we had a boy eight, and we commiserated for many years.
Thank goodness for parents who understood.
Yeah.
We came along.
They'll butt up against authority, and they will do things they want to do. They won't do things they don't want to do. They need to learn experientially. If they're bright, they may do extremely well in hands-on kinds of classes, and not well in abstract classes. When our son applied to the seminary, they let him in on probation. This is really a funny story. They let him in on probation because he had a physics major from college, and they didn't know if he could think abstractly, like a good theologian should. So he had to take a philosophy course that summer. And he called me up, and he had been, you know, listening to all these philosophies of this and philosophies of that. And he had to give a report. He had to pick a philosopher and give a report. He called and he said, "I have found the greatest philosopher. I'm so excited. I mean, it's just I didn't even know people thought this way. It's just everything I've always thought." And I said, "Well, who is it?" Guess who it was? Nietzsche. Fortunately, his professor had a good sense of humor. Okay, nines. Are nines going to make it? Are nines going to be valedictorian?
No.
And they're going to feel bad about it, probably. And they're going to get B pluses and A minuses. But
they're going to clean the chalkboard.
Yeah, they just don't have that obsessive push to, and they won't have ulcers, probably, and they're going to be a lot nicer people to have around.
They'll pal around with
valedictorians. Yeah. Okay. Does that give you some idea of how type can affect children? Any questions, comments? We have 1 minute left or two. I would, if you have adult children, I would strongly advocate not pushing it on them because then they'll reject it, but introducing the idea. We have discovered with our adult children that it's just an amazing tool to talk about things that you otherwise just couldn't talk about. You know, so they can say to you, Mom, you're just being such a seven. And, Mom, I don't need a positive spin right now. You know? And I can take it in that language rather than just being told, you just never understand me, Pooh, you know. So it gives you a whole language system for talk, for conversation, for understanding, and it really is a valuable, wonderfully valuable tool. So I would recommend it. And we'll see you all at 9 tomorrow morning for the final.
And if any of you that do have the Stanford test, make sure that you bring them tomorrow, because we're on the early mark. 10:45.
So I can keep it over there.